to work for the tax reform, because you can't add any positive factors. Remember, the people who appoint us are also usually members of the
NEC.
Sometimes they're very sympathetic to the executive. So they said, can a guy who can't add any factors? Now, before some business person or something misunderstands me, I want to make it very clear, that is not facetious. It's absolutely correct. Everybody knows it, even the peasants in Mongolia. Okay, Leta, there's your story for you. Useless tempers. On the finance. Okay, on a more serious note, or less serious note, I can't work out what. Welcome to whoever and everybody who's here, and in particular the new Zakhele Shlope with his new Mohawk style, which has reduced his age by 10 years. Linda, don't laugh. Linda, that's a story you should write. He's looking 10 years younger, isn't he? I wish I could have a Mohawk style. Who knows with gels and so on. All right, over to the less important part of this afternoon's meeting. It's to do with tax bills. Right, over to you. Moha and your team. Younger, I didn't miss you. With due respect, I like you, but I didn't miss you. Well, this is his forte.
So, thank you, Chair. Today, as you know, we're just here to... Okay, since I come so often here. But you've got the first slide with all the names of the people here and behind me. So, Chair, we're obviously just here today for the Tax Laws Amendment Bill and the Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill. If we just go to the next slide. Largely, as you know, on Budget Day, the Minister makes the budget announcement. Most of the rates issues and so on are dealt with in the Rates and Monetary Amounts and Amendment of Revenue Laws Amendment Laws Bill. Nice long name. But we call it the Rates Bill to simplify. And of course, that's the one that contains the proposal to take VAT from 14 to 15% and all the other changes to the personal income tax tables and so on. As you know, we don't consult on the tax proposals before they're announced in the budget. Now, with the rates bill, it's just the rates issue, so it's easy then to come up with a draft bill. The rest of the stuff, which is more complex, we've still got to go out, talk to people, see whether we got it right from the announcement, and we normally publish in July the TLAB and the TALAB bills. And that's what we have here before. We published them on the 16th July. And today, I think the kind of aim is largely then just to go through what the proposals are. I think both Parliament and the Treasury have a end date for comments. It's today for us, yeah. I think for the committee it's tomorrow. And obviously, Chair, that's what we'll hear next week in the hearings when people come in and comment on specific bills. So I think without much further ado, we can just shoot off. I know you've got some time constraints, so do you want to start with PIT?
The slide represent some of the bigger proposals of which we receive most comment on. Then there are proposals that are in the budget of which we have done changes in the legislations, but we have not included in the slides because no many comments have been received on those proposals. The first proposal that we have is clarifying the tax treatment and obligation of funds managed by bargaining council. Last year, we made changes in the tax legislation whereby we gave amnesty to bargaining councils that were not compliant. So during the public consultation process, it was said that moving forward, bargaining councils should be compliant, so we have to meet with them and consult with them and find ways of how they should be compliant. So the proposals now in the 2018 budget, in the draft bill, come up with ways of how bargaining councils should manage their tax affairs. For example, what we are saying is that here, if an employer contributes on behalf of an employee to the bargaining council, that employer is the one that will withhold pay YE on the amount contributed to the bargaining council fund. However, if the employee contributes directly to the bargaining council, that contribution by the employee is an after-tax money. So therefore, there won't be any pay YE withholding. The second issue is the funds, that is the reserves of the bargaining council funds that are in the bargaining council's account. So the tax treatment of those funds is that during public consultation, it came where bargaining councils told us that they have a tax exemption certificate from SARS. So we told them that those who have got official confirmation of income tax exemption from SARS, they'll be exempt from tax. But those who do not have an official confirmation, they'll be subject to tax. The second issue deals with removing taxable fringe benefits in relation to low or interest-free loans granted to low-income earning employees for low-cost housing. Currently, the Income Tax Act makes provision for when an employer provides the actual housing with a market value not exceeding $450,000 to an employee who earns about $250,000 per annum. There is no taxable fringe benefit on the housing. However, that dispensation is not extended when an employer provides a loan of such an amount. So what we are doing here, we are saying that if an employer provides a loan of not exceeding $450,000 instead of a house to an employee who earns income of $250,000 per annum, then for the purpose of acquiring a house, then there is not going to be a taxable fringe benefit. So, because currently, if the employer provides a house of $450,000 to an employee who earns at least $250,000 per annum, there is no taxable fringe benefit. So I'm saying that if you are not providing a house, now you are providing a loan, there is not going to be a taxable fringe benefit. The third one, addressing anomalies in respect of medical tax credits. What we have come across in practice is that you find that children, that is, if we've got a parent and maybe we have four children and we make medical aid contributions on behalf of our one parent, maybe mother, what we have seen in practice is that even though we split the contributions, but you find that when a person submits the tax return to SARS, they claim the whole amount of medical scheme contribution. Let's say if the medical scheme contribution is 500 and you have five children and you proportionally contribute 100, 100, 100, 100, we should be claiming 100, 100, 100 because that's what you are contributing. So what we found out is that now these children, like the people who are contributing on behalf of their parents, they are claiming the whole 500, whereas they proportionally contribute 100. So we are closing that loophole to say that if you are sharing the medical scheme contributions proportionally, then the expenditure should be split proportionally.
Thanks. Good afternoon. The next couple of points are on retirement funds. The first one is on the transfer of actuarial surplus between retirement funds. So we've seen some instances where an employer is trying to consolidate, trying to reduce the number of funds available to the employees. There's an actuarial surplus in one of the funds, and they're trying to move it across to the others. There was an unintended consequence of the exact wording in the legislation, which meant that that transfer within the employer between the different funds was a taxable event, so that the employees for whom they were transferring would then be taxed on that amount. Our tax policy principle is that for transfers between retirement funds, there isn't a tax consequence unless it's from, say, pension to provident. So this goes against our principle. We're trying to rectify that unintended consequence from that wording, and we're going to try and do it retrospectively so that transfers that have taken place already won't be taxed. The next point is on the alignment of the tax treatment of withdrawals from preservation funds and pension and provident preservation funds upon immigration or repatriation on expiry of the work visa. So if you are a member of a retirement annuity fund and then you were to immigrate, you are allowed to take the full value of your lump sum offshore with you. You do pay the withdrawal tax table amount, so you do pay tax on that amount, but you can get access to that lump sum and move overseas. if you were part of a pension fund and you went into a pension preservation fund after the end of your employment, that is not available to you. That option is not available to you. So this proposal is to say that we are trying to match the treatment between retirement annuity funds, pension preservation funds, and provident preservation funds, so that they're all treated in the same way, so that if you were to immigrate, you can take a lump sum with you after you've paid your withdrawal lump sum tax. At the moment, only retirement annuity funds can take the amount offshore, the pension preservation and the provident preservation can't. This is on the tax treatment of transfers to pension preservation or provident preservation funds after reaching normal retirement age, but before your retirement date. So we've done a number of amendments in the past few years to give individuals more flexibility upon retirement. Previously, if you hit your normal retirement age after you've been working at an employer, you'd be forced into taking an annuity and, in effect, starting your retirement. A few years ago, we allowed individuals not to be forced to take their annuity immediately. They could just hold off and keep the money in the employer fund, and then they could retire, elect to retire, we called it, at a later date. So you could consult or do something else for a while, and then only after a period could you then take their retirement. Last year, we tried to give even more flexibility by saying, if you leave your employer but you haven't elected to retire, you can transfer that amount to a retirement annuity fund. And then that retirement annuity fund can keep the money for you until you want to receive annuity at some later point. This year, we agreed last year for pension and provident funds that we would allow the transfer into a pension preservation fund or a provident preservation fund after retirement as well. So that, again, this is the same alignment as previously. It will be aligned between retirement annuity funds, pension preservation fund, and provident preservation fund. So if you leave your employer, you can transfer your amount into any of these funds after retirement, and then when you elect to retire, you can take it. The big difference here is you normally, if you move into those funds, you can have a one-off withdrawal. You can take your full amount as cash if you were to resign your job and you moved into a pension preservation fund or a provident preservation fund. You can take it as a one-off withdrawal. Here, we won't allow that because this is after retirement, because otherwise it will create a loophole when everybody retires, they don't elect to retire, they put into the fund, and then they take it all as cash. So there will be a new bucket in those funds where you can't take it as a lump sum. But it should extend flexibility for retirees. Okay.
The next set of slides deals with business tax proposals. Last year, we made changes in the Income Tax Act regarding anti-avoidance rules dealing with share buybacks and dividend stripping. As you know, during public hearings, there were a lot of comments on this to say that you are being too draconian, we limit vanilla transactions that have got nothing to do with anti-avoidance. So in order to rectify this, the next slide, Chris. In order to rectify this, and based on the comments and the meetings we had last year, because we said last year that we're going to look at the comments and see what changes we can do in the following year. So in order to rectify, or in order to try to limit the strict application of the rules where there is no need to apply the rules, we come with the new definition of preference shares for purposes of anti-dividend stripping rules. And secondly, there was a view that we said in the last year's legislation that corporate reorganization rules will not apply if the dividend stripping rules apply. And then they said that you do corporate reorganization rules because the income tax allows you to do so. So what we are proposing this year is the clawback rule to say that if you did a corporate reorganization, a corporate structuring, and then within 18 months, after that corporate structuring, you do the dividend stripping, then you'll be caught. So we are doing a clawback. We allow you to do corporate restructuring, and we're not going to do anything. However, but if you do a distribution within 18 months after that corporate restructuring, then there's going to be a clawback. And the next one, which is also a consequential amendment based on last year, is the application of the debt relief rules. You remember during public consultation, SITE came to Parliament to say that the rules are draconian and then we are too strict. And then because the last year's changes, for example, we triggered the debt relief rules when a debtor and creditor were changing the terms and conditions of the debt. And then now, in this year, what we are proposing this year, after public consultation, as Mama has said, that in some of the amendments, we have had meetings with the taxpayers when we are in the process of drafting. So we had, now we published the bill, we're still going to receive some comments. When we meet with taxpayers, they submit comments to us maybe before we draft, but that does not mean that we're going to take everything that they said. Hence now there's a second round of comments. So what we are proposing in this legislation is that the debt relief rules should only apply upon realization, that is when the debt is extinguished. And also, the debt relief rules are going to apply only on interest-bearing debt. They're not going to apply if the debt is not interest-bearing. And also, we're going to make changes to the effective date. So now, because we are correcting what we have done last year, the effective date, we are changing it so that it should be 1 January 2018, which is the same effective date we have in the bill because we are correcting what we have done last year. But that said, we have some, during public consultation we had with the taxpayers when we were drafting the bill, they told us that there are some other loopholes that are there that we need to close. So we'll be closing those loopholes also in this draft legislation. But it will be based on the comments that we received from them, of which the closing date is today, to see how we may change it further. The next proposal deals with tax implications of fruitless and wasteful expenditure in respect of public entities. Every time in November, we write to taxpayers, we publish in the website, submit comments, maybe for inclusion or for minister's consideration for the budget the following year. We receive these comments from taxpayers regarding the non-deductibility of fruitless and wasteful expenditure in respect of public entities. So what we are proposing here is that if an expenditure is regarded as fruitless and wasteful in terms of PFMA, that expenditure is not going to qualify for deduction in terms of Section 11A of the Income Tax Act. We are still waiting comments in this regard. The next one is the tax treatment of amounts received by portfolios of collective investment schemes. In this one, what we are proposing is that, and it is based on the comments and on what government became aware because there was whistleblowing, that some taxpayers are using collective investment schemes for purposes of trading rather than for long-term investors. And when they do so, they are saying that the amount cannot be regarded as revenue, and the amount is of a capital nature even though they are trading. And if the amount is of a capital nature, it will be taxable as CGT, and if it's revenue, it's taxable as revenue at the 45% versus 8%, like capital gains tax inclusion. So what happens is that when we've got that, we have meetings with FSB, Official Moment called Financial Sector Conduct Authority. We had meetings with Financial Sector Conduct Authority, we have had meetings with SARS, and we had meetings also with the CIS, two meetings with them. During the meetings with them, we proposed the following, that what we proposed is a one-year holding period rule to say that if a CIS acquired an instrument, and you acquired the instrument maybe in January, and you did not distribute anything from that instrument within 6 months, then you are fine. But if you acquire an instrument in January and you distribute maybe in June, then you'll be caught by the rules. So we are proposing a one-year holding period rule. And what we are proposing is a first-in, first-out method to say, first-in, first-out, you mean that you must say which instrument you acquired first and which instrument you disposed of first. So that's what we are proposing. During the meetings with the CIS, some of them agreed with that. They said the proposal is fair because now we are bringing certainty to the tax rules and all that. Because the definition of revenue versus capital is not defined in the Act, the amounts that are treated as a capital nature would depend on the case law. So now, by saying that 1 year holding period rule, everything that is distributed within 12 months will be treated as revenue, it brings certainty. That said, we got a letter, I think Momo can comment on this issue, that we've got comments already, even before the bill was drafted in this regard, from ASISA regarding the proposal.
So that's fine.
Okay. The next one is clarification of the tax treatment of doubtful debts. What happens is that in 2015, amendments were made in the Income Tax Act to remove the commissioner's discretion. And we amended Section 11J in this regard. And we said that the commissioner's discretion, there will be a set criteria which will be gazetted, which will set out the rules of how the doubtful debts will be claimed. So what happened is that that notice was never published. And as you are aware, last year, we made changes in the legislation for the tax treatment of doubtful debts for banks that are regulated by the South African Reserve Bank. And now we are doing the tax treatment of doubtful debts for any other financial institution that is not a bank and not regulated by the South African Reserve Bank. And these are our proposals. And then the next one is allowing the newly licensed South African exchange to utilize the REIT. In 2012, we introduced the REIT system in the Income Tax Act, and we referred to a REIT which is licensed in Johannesburg Stock Exchange. By then, there was only...
Look, man, I'm not as conversant with some of the issues as others may be. What's a REIT?
Real Estate Investment Trust.
Oh, right. Yes. You know, I regret, actually, Momo and others here, that Tandi's not here, because she, especially from our side, ANC side, she specializes, well, grudgingly, but she does, on tax issues. Also, I should register the absence of people for legitimate reasons. Nati is on other deployment. Tandi is on family leave. Dikiledi's got a doctor's appointment. And Peggy Konyeni is involved with the new PEC in KZN, right? So she's not going to be available on Thursdays and Fridays, but there we are. So they all have good reasons for not being here.
Okay. Yes. So in 2016, South Africa granted new stock exchanges about 4 licenses to new stock exchanges. So the problem was that the Income Tax Act was referring to a REIT as listed in Johannesburg Stock Exchange. So now what we are doing is we are making changes in the legislation to allow other 4 exchanges to use the REIT legislation, provided that the listing requirements are approved by the minister by the FSB in consultation with the minister, by Financial Sector Conduct Authority. And the last one is tax issues resulting from the Insurance Act. The new Insurance Act came into effect in 2018, so it changed some parts of the short-term and long-term insurance. So the new Insurance Act allowed now short-term insurers to operate a branch in South Africa. So because now short-term insurers are allowed to operate a branch in South Africa, we are making changes in Section 28 of the Act to refer to that provision. The next one is tax incentives. In the budget, we announced the success story of the venture capital companies that we introduced in 2008. Currently, there are about 122 approved by SARS, and 2 of those have been withdrawn from the list. And the venture capital companies assist SMMEs in getting funding. For example, if an investor, an individual investor, invests in a VCC, the individual gets an upfront deduction. And then the VCC will then invest in a qualifying company. So we announced in the budget that we're going to make changes in the tax legislation to correct the administrative and technical issues that make it difficult for the VCC to use the VCC legislation. And secondly, we made announcement in the budget, the second one, whereby you said you're going to close abusive schemes that we have seen on the VCCs. So what we are proposing here is that because before the budget, we've seen in the media and also on websites, some websites, whereby they are advising tax structures using the VCC regime. So we said in the budget, that was in Chapter 4, that will close all the abusive schemes regarding the VCC. So what we are doing here is that what we are limiting is that the investor will invest in a VCC, and then the VCC will invest in a qualifying company. So we are limiting the abuse of trading between an investor who invested in that VCC and the qualifying company, because what we have seen is that an investor will invest in a VCC, and then the VCC invests in a qualifying company, and then the investor now trades with the qualifying company, and then that we are limiting that abuse. And then the second abuse that we are limiting is that we find out now that there will be a big business or a big company whereby there will be a separation, like a small company will be formed out of that big company, and then that qualifying company, the VCC investors will invest in that qualifying company which has been structured from that big company. And then they issue a different class of shares, preference shares, so that those investors can qualify for VCC tax deduction. So hence, we are closing the abuse to say that if you are a VCC or a qualifying company, you may not issue more than one class of shares. And then the next one is the review of international shipping rules. Currently, we have in the tax legislation section 12Q, whereby we make provision, because we don't have tonnage tax in the South African tax system, but we make provision for if you use a South African ship and then you qualify for a tax relief. But you must be using a ship that is registered in South Africa. And the policy rationale for that, we wanted to increase the South African shipping registry. So the shipping industry came to us to say that because we are seeing a South African ship, there is a problem whereby they have to use or lease a ship because the ship is undergoing repairs or maintenance. So we are making changes in the Act to say that if you are a South African company using a South African ship, but you use a replacement ship for a short period of time because your ship is undergoing maintenance or repairs, then you will qualify. And the short period of time will be short. It should be less than 6 months. And then reviewing the write-off period for electronic communication cables. Currently, the Income Tax Act makes provision for depreciation allowance in respect of electronic communication cables. However, the depreciation allowance depends on whether the taxpayer owns the asset or leases the asset. So you find that if maybe you own the asset, the allowance is 10 years, and if you lease it, maybe the asset, the depreciation allowance is 15 years. So what we are aligning the Act to say that whether you lease the electronic communication cable or you own it, the years for depreciation will be the same. It will be 10 years or the number of years in which the taxpayer is entitled to use the asset, whichever is the lesser. So we are aligning the depreciation period whether you own or lease the asset.
Thanks, Jenga. We do have one amendment on the employment tax incentive in the draft bill. That amendment is an extension of the ETI for a further 5 years from 2019 to 2024, but with an interim report being required on its performance to be published after 3 years. So this program, given this committee did ask for a review previously, and we did do a previous review that went through NEDLAC, and we gave another extension, but that extension was 2 years. This is, the draft bill has a slightly longer extension. The consultations with NEDLAC are currently taking place. There's actually a meeting at NEDLAC that started 40 minutes ago today, which is on this exact issue. So there will be a review of the incentive, an updated review in terms of its impact on employment, its impact on wages, its impact on the length of time that individuals who are beneficiaries of the scheme are employed, and that will be taking place, and it will be reviewed with all the other constituencies in NEDLAC. So we're hoping that that process and that NEDLAC process will be able to provide a report to the committee later on in the year to give an update on its progress so far.
The first one is addressing an overlap in the treatment of dividends for income tax and transfer pricing purposes. Currently, Section 1 of the income tax define a dividend which qualifies for maybe some treaty relief. However, when we do a transfer pricing adjustment, our Section 31 deemed that amount to be a dividend, which is subject to a dividend withholding tax. So we find that now there is an overlap with regard to the dividend in specie in terms of Section 31 and the meaning of dividend in terms of Section 1. And that's what we have found in practice, that we do a secondary adjustment in terms of Section 31, and then there's an overlap, and that amount is deemed as a dividend. We don't want an amount that is regarded as a dividend in specie in terms of Section 31 to be regarded as a dividend in terms of Section 1, so that that amount can get a treaty relief, because that was a penalty. So we are addressing that anomaly now to say that if we have done a secondary adjustment in terms of Section 31, that dividend will not get a treaty relief in terms of some of the tax treaties. The next one is the rules addressing the use of trust to avoid tax in respect of controlled foreign companies. What happened is that last year we made changes in the tax legislation regarding the use of trust to avoid CFC legislation. And then during the public consultation, we were told that our proposed changes are too wide and more complex. So we said that whatever we had last year, we're going to address it during the 2018 legislative cycle. And we made those proposals also in the budget. So based on public consultation we had with the taxpayers, they advised us that, yes, the issue is regarding Section 7 of the Income Tax Act and Section 25 and paragraphs and the 8 schedule, not the actual CFC legislation. So what we are doing now, we are saying that if you distribute dividends and you qualified for a participation exemption, the participation exemption will be disregarded if those dividends are from a company that could have been a controlled foreign company in terms of the Income Tax Act. So we disregard participation exemption in all. So that's what we are saying, that you won't have participation exemption in respect of amounts that would have been subject to tax if that company was regarded as a CFC. That's what we are doing. And in terms of value-added tax, there's only one proposal, because other proposals regarding VAT, the issue is the e-commerce, of which those proposals are done by regulations. And we have had public consultation on the regulations, and we'll be issuing the revised draft regulations for the second round of comments. And then the VAT proposal is the clarification of the definition of face value of a debt transferred under the provisions dealing with irrecoverable debts. This is a simple proposal, because we are taking the policy rationale, which is explained in the EM, because the EM, the policy rationale is clear of what is the meaning of the face value, but the income tax, the VAT Act is not clear. So we are clarifying in the VAT Act what is the definition of face value based on the EM that was issued in 1997. That's all. I'm going to hand over to Franz now for Talab.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair, members. So I'll try and keep this fairly brief. So just moving on directly to the income tax changes. Here, a significant change is something that's been called for a while now. We've been progressively relaxing the requirement to put in a return for recipients of exempt dividends. And essentially what we're now doing is we're doing away for that requirement completely. We started off with people who got a dividend through a tax-free savings account. We then extended that to retirement funds, and now we're taking it out completely because we don't think it's necessary at this time. In the future, if we detect that there are problems emerging, we may have to reintroduce such a requirement, but not at this stage. Moving on to the Customs and Excise Act, understandably, when people know that there is a likely increase in excise duties, they move large amounts of product out of their warehouses shortly before the increase occurs, therefore forestalling the increase. And the proposal here is to permit the commissioner to set the norm, in other words, to work out what the general usage would be. And if you try and take more than that out of your warehouse prior to an increase, that would not be permitted. and thereby protect or ensure that you cannot sort of preempt the increase. Something that I suspect taxpayers would quite welcome is the extension of the right or for compromise provisions in the Tax Administration Act to the Customs and Excise Act. Classically, Customs and Excise has been a pay-as-you-stand-there system, but obviously business has moved on since the many years ago when that was the case, and you now have deferrals and accounts where people have debts that are owed to the Revenue Service, and obviously sometimes those debts go become uncollectible, so we need a provision to deal with those, and that's what we're doing here. Off to the Value Added Tax Act. This particular debate reminded me of how many angels dance on the head of a pin, because the problem here is you may have an error in an invoice, which means it cannot be classified as a tax invoice for VAT purposes. Now, for most people in this room, what's the difference between an invoice and a tax invoice? You don't have to worry about it. People who pay VAT have to worry about that difference. And there's a rule in the VAT Act that says you cannot have two tax invoices. So SARS's position has always been, well, because there's this error there, this invoice isn't a tax invoice, therefore you can correct it and then it becomes a tax invoice. But taxpayers have been a little uncomfortable with that concept. I mean, they printed tax invoice on this thing to begin with. So what we're saying here is if that kind of error exists, you are allowed to correct it. You will not be committing an offense by issuing two tax invoices, but please maintain an audit trail so that we can see what happened when that all happened. Credit notes. So this is really just to assist if one company takes over another. You have a situation where it wasn't the person who supplied the goods who has to give the credit note now, because the new person has taken over that business, and that creates some friction in the VAT system. So we're removing that friction now and saying the purchaser can in fact now issue the credit note. Special returns, this comes into play when you have someone taking, let's assume you didn't pay your bill, it was for fixing your motor car, the mechanic has a lien over the motor car and sells the motor car in order to satisfy the debt. There's a special return that has to be filled in for VAT purposes, and what we're suggesting here is we do away with that return and just require that you keep records of what happened. We now get on to another interesting one. In the VAT Act, unlike the Income Tax Act and most of our other legislation, one legal entity can have multiple branches. So you can have company, and the company has six branches separated around the country, and each of those branches can have its own VAT number. So what happens if five of those branches pay their VAT? Two of them have a refund due, and one doesn't pay its VAT and has a debt. Can we offset? Well, from a purely legal perspective, we should be able to. It's one single legal entity, but the VAT Act has complicated matters by treating them as separate vendors, and this clarifies that in alignment with the normal legal position, we can then set off across the various sub-entities, if you want to call them that, or that is even too strong because they're not sub-entities, it's just a single entity, but those branches. Joint ventures. Joint ventures are very similar to partnerships, so we're suggesting that they should be treated in the same way when it comes to joint and several liability for what happens in the joint venture. Tax Administration Act. So how do you know when you're being audited? Well, if you're being audited and we're not just verifying that what you... So we have a different process in SARS. If we're asking you a relatively simple question, it's a verification. You know, can you please confirm that you received this amount of interest? Because what's happened is SARS has a record from a bank that says you got 1,000, but you've put 100 on your tax return. We'd like to find out which is right, as opposed to a full audit. And so how as a taxpayer do you know which you're undergoing? So what we're suggesting is that when SARS launches an audit, we make mandatory something that is generally done, is we send you an audit engagement letter to say, here is the audit, this is the scope, with the initial scope of the audit, and then you will know you are being audited and that's the process you're being subject to, as opposed to the shorter process. And then one that I suspect the committee will hear some comment about, and this is the deregistration of tax non-compliant tax practitioners. it does seem odd that a tax practitioner who doesn't put their tax returns in and doesn't pay their tax debts should continue to advise their clients, because you would suspect that someone who isn't doing their own job for their own returns is probably not doing a very good job for their clients. Equally, however, we appreciate that mistakes are made. And so the suggestion here is if someone is continuously or regularly for a period of more than 3 months in six being non-compliant, and that means has outstanding tax debts that are not being disputed and therefore and for which a suspension of payment has been given, or simply don't file their tax returns, then SARS needs to notify that tax practitioner that they need to correct the situation within a period, and if they ignore that notification, they then become subject to deregistration as tax practitioners. Obviously, if they correct the situation, they can come back on board again. Customs Control Act, so this is the new customs legislation, and the first one's a relatively simple one. Currently, the legislation says when a truck with cargo leaves the country, you need to let us know about it. But we're interested in knowing about the movement of trucks, because if it's a foreign truck that has come in, we want to make sure that it's leaving again. It isn't sort of staying here without having paid duties on the truck itself, and also to keep track of trucks that are coming out and coming back in. So the requirement for cargo to be on the truck is removed. You need to let us know that the truck is moving. And that is similar to what would happen with a ship or an aircraft. Again, write-off for compromise of tax debt, similarly as has been done in the old Customs Act, a similar extension of the Tax Administration Act's provisions for write-offs and compromises is proposed. And that is the end of the tax administration aspects, and we now move on to broader policy issues, I think.
Chair, we're just going to get into issues that are not in the bill, okay? So I think the first issue, obviously, is the VAT zero rating and what happens now that the report's been published. As you're aware, the panel was appointed by the minister, and they submitted their report last week, Monday, the 6th of August. We released the report for public comment last week on the 10th, and the main panel recommendations, just for those who don't know, is that the panel felt that we should include white bread, bread flour, cake flour, sanitary products, school uniforms and nappies. But for each of the recommendations, the report suggested that Treasury must do further work to ensure that the benefits of zero rating are not captured by producers and retailers. The report also suggests that the rollout of free sanitary pads to the poor is accelerated, and also commented on other expenditure programs to mitigate the impact on poor households. They didn't go into it in detail, they just kind of mentioned that. And if you recall, I mean, they had a very short time to really prepare this report. So the minister, as soon as he received it last week when we released it, he's just requested a further round of quick comments. And I think, Chair, what we'd need at some point is just some guidance on the parliamentary process. I'm aware that Parliament has scheduled, or SCOF has scheduled, for the panel to come and present their report. I don't know if you want to have a separate round of public hearings, or whether what the minister has done is going to be sufficient, but obviously we're ready for both. Once we get comments, and if there are further parliamentary hearings, we'll then have a response to the panel and translate that into whatever legislative changes that are necessary, and that would go with the rates bill. So, as you're aware, we still have to table those bills, and that's normally done in October, that's the latest we can do it. So that's when we would do it. So I guess at some point we just require guidance on this. The second issue, Chair, just to be alerted to, is an old issue, which is still a retirement, the issue of annuitization of provident funds. If we can just recall, the current version of the tax laws is that
come 1st of March 2019, Provident funds will be required to annuitize. So that's if you do nothing. You may recall that for the last, we've done it twice, we've extended the period. And currently this matter is still before NEDLAC. We're going through the comprehensive social security reform paper process with them. We've tried to get this matter fast-tracked. So far, there's been no agreement. Even yesterday, we had a meeting on this matter, and tomorrow we have a further meeting. So we're hoping that there'll be some agreement on what to do, and we've pointed out doing nothing means that the reform takes effect. So therefore, they have to decide on something if they don't want the reform to take effect. And so I think you should expect further amendments, which we'll submit again in a final bill when it comes before you. Needless to say, the longer the delay, the longer you have this situation where some members of the public or members of retirement funds receive a tax deduction but are not required to annuitize. Chair, then just on the other tax bills before you, as you're aware, the draft carbon tax bill, we've had the response document already presented to the committee in June. At that meeting, we were requested, so we've responded to the public comments, and we're working on just making the necessary changes as outlined in that response document. We were further requested to go to NEDLAC to discuss the impact on jobs. So a task team's been set up. It's met a few times. They've had 4 meetings, and we've agreed on the sectors that will be looked at, and I believe NEDLAC has submitted an interim report to you on this. So, Chair, I think as far as the Treasury is concerned, because I think even there people don't think this process needs to delay the bill, that we could also publish and table the final bill based on the response document, and this report will go in parallel with that. Chair, just the last issue just to bring to your attention. The Minister of Finance, at that time it was Minister Gigaba, in the budget speech, announced that he would also introduce draft legislation to improve the accountability of SARS in the way it reports, particularly to the Minister of Finance, and this was based on the recommendations made by the Davis Tax Committee on its report on tax administration, which it published last year. We've been in discussions with the Nugent Commission as well, and we understand that they are considering issues of governance at SARS, and they will be making proposals. So the Minister felt that rather than proceed with this draft legislation, he wants to await the findings from the Nugent Commission, which will be done by, I think the reporting date is November, end of November, and at that point, I think, to therefore introduce the draft legislation next year, not this year. Yeah, I know it's an election year, eh?
For the next 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, next year will be a short year. So, Chair, I just thought we'd just bring you up to date on all the other tax issues. And that's done with the presentation.
Such
as you are?
No, meaning in numbers. I don't know what else I could mean. I could mean many things, yes, especially with you two. My unconscious is operating. Well, consciously I meant, you know, can I stress to, before you speak, Mr. Lee, can I make it clear to stakeholders who are here from civil society? Never mind my banter. I am who I am. I want to stress that we take tax issues very, very seriously. And we have a very good team. Antonia, who's our researcher, is actually a tax expert, formerly of Treasury. You know that, Mo? She was... Antonia Manamela was in Treasury before. You know that, yeah? Okay. And then we have an excellent content advisor, Zakele Shlope. And we have an emerging tax expert in Thandi Tobias Pokolo, and we have a tax expert, Mr. Lisia. Okay? One of the best person that used to be here from the DA is no more here, Mr. Topham. But that's another story. Yeah, I never lived that one down. Anyway, so over to Mr. Lisia. And we actually, you know what, also to communicate to stakeholders, we have this process where on Tuesday we'll have public hearings. I've indicated I won't be here for family reasons, and Thandi will be chairing. But we will also then put every submission people make onto our table, and then between the two people and our staff side, technical experts, ourselves, and what we hear from the public, we look at everything carefully, and the members, particularly those of us who are not as proficient on tax issues, say, as Mr. Lee said, we get to grips with the things later down the road. Actually, Momo, to be fair, it's when civil society comes here and the experts that you get a better grasp of what the issues are. And then we start reading and so on. This is our first foray, but we take these bills very seriously. They have huge impacts for society, and it's not as if we take it any less seriously than anything else. Over to you, Mr. Lee. I'm covering up for my silly billy points at the beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm quite happy to be rated third best or whatever you choose, but here we go. Mr. Chairman, through you, there's a lot to absorb here. Just a couple of points for now. The VAT set off, I think it was you, across branches. What about across periods? In other words, the different branches, because there are always delays, or not always, there are very frequently delays, and then, as I understood the tax on but recommendations that you shouldn't be holding back a refund for a period because another period requires a payment, as it were. So how does that fit into the to the cross branches one. In, I just need some more clarity about this audit notification versus this term that you guys are using of verification. On personal income tax, if you insert a zero in certain fields, even though you're not claiming any tax deduction, you simply put a zero there, it triggers a so-called verification process. And then you asked to verify something you haven't actually claimed at all. So that's a technical a software thing. But
I'm just interested. How do you know that? That when does how do you know?
I've experienced it personally, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay, but it's nothing from what they said, obviously.
But what I am
it's related to what they said.
I'm interested in this audit versus verification and notice. How it works there, in terms of the trigger mechanism, but also the difference between an audit and a verification. The truck movement issue. How practically are we dealing with that? The truck's got to go through the border post. It has to go through the process like any other motor vehicle, whether it's a truck or a motorcycle. I just don't really understand the problem. How do trucks get through without being you not knowing about them? That's I suppose more whether it's got a load on it or doesn't have a load on it. Some clarity on that. Then the question of the proposed zero rating, additional items to be zero rated. As I understand the media reports, is about a 4.8 billion rand revenue sacrifice there. Is that figure sort of the right kind of figure? And if so, where are we looking at recovering it? How are we looking at recovering it? I won't ask you about the items. I mean, I'm really quite surprised that something like white bread is suggested as something to help the poor. I would think that we should be encouraging all people, rich and poor, to eat more healthy food, brown bread, for instance. But anyway, that's not something that you guys can deal with. And quite curious in a sense that a year or so ago we were fighting to get the more healthy bread zero rated, and now we're going to have white bread zero rated. Anyway, that's what we might have it zero rated. That there's no conclusion there. Mermay, you're saying that the preservation annuitization will go ahead if there's nothing done to stop it going ahead. In the 2 years that we've stopped it, we've slowed it down, have we any idea what the tax sacrifice has been? Because what we've done is we've exempted, or we've prevented the taxation of people who simply take their money and go and buy appliances or whatever they want to do. What is this costing us every year in just in revenue? I know the objective surely is to preserve the money for retirement. Certainly that, I think, would be our objective. But at the same time, if the money is taken and spent, we need to collect the revenue, the tax on it. And we're not doing that at the moment. So I'm just wondering, have you got any idea of what the loss in revenue is at the moment? Chairman, let me leave it at that.
Two quick things. One is on collective investment schemes, right? Which slide is it, Younger? Slide 21, right? Can you tell me a bit more about what you're doing here? I don't understand what you're saying, right? Tax treatment and why. Doubtful debts. What a doubtful debt. Right. Then I want to know a bit about one more slide. Sorry. While I'm thinking of the third slide, I wanted to raise a question about what was it? Oh, yes, ETI. Now, this employment tax incentive, we welcomed it. I think the majority party wanted to continue. Right? You said you're doing some analysis of it, right? And then we said to you, if I recall, well, let's see what the analysis shows, the review shows, before you implement it. And now, where is that? Are you saying there's a further one being done that will only emerge in year three of the extension of year five? Well, have you already done one? Okay, you raised that, right? I remember this debate, and I think the ANC at least, I don't know about other parties, we wanted to continue, right? Then on the matter of the annuitization, right? Excuse me. Now, if I understand correctly, the period, 2 year period lapses at the beginning of next financial year. That's correct. Now, obviously, as we're going to have public hearings next week, and even if like COSATU and other union federations don't pick it up now, they'll pick it up on the eve of us voting on it. So what we don't want is the saga we had the last time. And I'm pleading, Momo, that all the structures, appropriate structures, discuss it. As far as the political structures go, I will also raise it, right? So we want to stress that I can't see COSATU agreeing with this. I can't speak for other federations, unless they've actually agreed, Prunedlac and so on, right? So it's not by omission that this happens. I know they're having a conference in September. I think it's the 17th onwards for 4 days. And I'm presuming it'll come up there too. Then on the issue of the VAT, it's an interesting thing you're asking. It's a great pity we didn't think this through, partly because you're not in Parliament and, you know, your other responsibilities eclipse your parliamentary one. But ideally what we should have done is have the public hearings next week Tuesday on both the TLAB and TALAB bills and the VAT report. I didn't really think we'll deliver by the end of July anyway, at least the panel wouldn't. But I don't know, you see, the members will have to speak for themselves, the ANC is not here in its numbers, it has to be discussed. Personally, I'm thinking of myself, I think we should have a public hearing, which means we have to do an advert very quickly, and we have to find a date. I will confer with the WIP and persuade the ANC members, and I think they'll agree. So, where's Zuki? Are you here? Oh, she's not here. Okay, fine. So I'll remember to do that. Okay, so I would like to suggest we'd like a public hearing. Secondly, you know, given that this is a very short month, and you can see the attendance here, what would be, I went to phone you yesterday to speak to you about this moment, but I just got caught up in another thing. What would be the outermost date we can pass the Trade and Monetary Amendments Bill before, you know, the Minister gazettes the final version and brings it through the MTBPS process, right? The TLAB and TLAB bills. So what I'm asking is, you have to think of the outermost dates because, you know, the VAT thing is extremely contentious, right? And my sense is we got a response from the NGOs. They're not happy. COSATU is not happy. I saw the statement in the media. So, and I can tell you now, at least until this report, the majority, if not almost everybody in the ANC study group is not happy. But just to remind you, for what it's worth, on May Day, the Secretary General of the ANC said he's opposed to it. I don't know where he is now. I don't know whether he's speaking on his own behalf or the NWC or what. So it means a lot of work. There's a parliamentary structure that will deal with it in an open and transparent way, but there's also alliance structures that will deal with it, right? Not in the hype, you know. These things are in the media anyway, these alliance statements. So what I'm saying is, Momo, you've got to be realistic about time frames. It's not, we can work 24 hours a day here, but the point is that there are, you know, these processes. So what I'm saying is, can you give me a quick date when you reply? Outermost date to pass the Race and Monetary Bill and the TLAB and TALAB Bill, right, so that you guys can do your side from the executive. But I also need to point out that given the VAT issue, there's an overlap now between the Race and Monetary Bill and the TLAB and TALAB Bill. What we can quickly do, colleagues, and I think we can do this pretty fast, is the non-VAT sections of the Race and Monetary Bill. That can be processed quickly. Mr. Meni has come back to us and said that his whip, his chief whip, and he have agreed that to use Thursday afternoons. I think we should start doing that. But we can only do it if there's no three-line whip pending. The difficulty with the program, as you can see, next week was meant to be an open week. Now it is a plenary. And I've spoken to the chief whip's office. They're saying that given the limited time we now have, there'll be plenaries every week. So we're in big trouble, really, time-wise. Then on the carbon tax bill, since you raised it, just to let members, the Environment Committee in good faith put the 29. But we told them, look, men, personally, I don't have turf issues, but the bill is not referred to both committees. It's a money bill. It'll have to come here. And they can't have a workshop, and then we not be there. And the 29 clashes with Steinhoff. So Mapolani said to me, no, it's fine. He thought I'd suggested 29, but he didn't come back to me. So in short, carbon tax bill, you can't go ahead with that workshop, but they're calling it off on the 29th. And we have to be realistic about that too. Now, I looked at the NEDLAC report. If I understand it correctly, they haven't come to any agreement yet. And I saw you said now that end of October is the plan. Is that correct? So how are we going to process the carbon tax bill effectively without that report coming back to us? We can tinker with it, but we can't really vote on it or finish it. What we have suggested to you, just Tandi's view, and I agreed with that, remember, is that our aim with the carbon tax bill is to finish before the end of the financial year. We don't intend to finish by December. We can't, anyway. And so we have to be realistic. I don't know what happens in your party structures, but around, let's say, October, November, December, it's, you know, all the list processes. Or you do it differently. You have appointments. And we have, like, you know, yeah. But it's also a lot. But, you know, here, ours is slightly very different, actually. You know, it's branches. So members, you know, I don't mean myself. I mean, I'm too old to bother with those things that I ever did. They have to be at those list conferences, and they have to be seen in the constituencies. You know how elections are, Momo. I mean, it's normal. It's nothing to do with us. In Britain, they do the same thing. You think they're in their constituencies as much in the last 6 weeks before an election as they are in the previous 5 years and 9 months? No. So where you think you're going? And remember, our ANC comrades, they are all in provincial executive committees or SACP or, well, one of them is not. So how are you going to process both? No. And the thing is, I've written repeatedly, thrice to the ministers concerned. Nobody listens. Chief Whip, everybody I've written, on basis of mandate, that what happens, Mr. Lees, I've been around for a long time. Yeah. But the point is, every fifth term in the last 6 months, ministers pile out with bills, right? Partly, they don't know whether they're going to come back to the same position. Even if they come back to cabinet, they can move you, right? So you want to finish issues quickly. Partly, it's just sheer egoism, you know, this legacy issue. I mean, who believes in legacies now? Who even remembers who was the Minister of Labour in the first 10 years? I can't even remember. I can't remember who was the Minister of Labour 3 months ago. I don't even, you forget, it's such a big executive. So look, all of this, Momo, I'm tired of raising it. You show me now how many ANC members are there. Now the point is, you see, the minister and deputy minister will be more conciliatory, right? The DG will be conciliatory. This man. He's a workaholic. That's why I always protect and not protect, I defend you, because really, Momo, despite my arguments and things, you're a remarkable civil servant. I mean, I'm sure you have your inner tensions and so on, but workaholism, you're remarkable. And you're a great credit to your department and this country. But Momo, you've got to get real. The expert on tax from our side is not even here. Is this thing being cast on 408 maybe? Somebody watch this thing because she's going to chair on Tuesday. So get real, Momo. We can discuss offline, but in fairness to the DA, because I've got to reshape the program, then they get annoyed with me. Right, they will say, hey, what's he hiding? You know, all we do is we change the dates around. Yeah, they see conspiracies now. So basically, we need one date for a hearing. Look, Mr. Lees, will you respond when we've got him here? We need to reshape the program. My own view is we should have a hearing on the VAT report. So you're fine with that. Okay, let me speak to Tandy, and then we'll sort that out. We'll sort that date in. Okay, you give us some dates now so we can reshape the program and give it to members by Tuesday. Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, maybe let me start with the process issues. I mean, I think, you know, the issue is that we do need the revenue. So whatever we do, whether it's getting more zero-rated products after the hearing, etc., we do need the rates bill and the T-Lab and TALAP to be passed by the end of the year. Okay?
Yes. Well, it's like a little clarity.
It means as long as we pass it by the end of November.
Yeah.
But then what happens now, because we've done this before, I hope the other members are listening. Previously we finished a bill, then you would bring it in the MTBPS process, more or less a final bill, right? Because amending it after that, you require to go through the Torturous Money Bills Act process, right? So what we have always, or almost always done, is finish the bill, say, 2 weeks before the MTBPS.
Yeah.
Now, the MTBPS is on the 24th, right? So, 2 weeks before that is the 10th. Parliament is not sitting from the 17th of September to the 8th of October. Yeah, well, I don't decide these things. And no one's going to come, eh? Remember the last quarter, the ANC, this process is in full swing. So can we talk out offline? What I'm trying to alert the DA to is that I'm going to make other changes now. Not, we don't change the issues
We just juggle around the dates depending on issues like this that have emerged, right?
Yeah.
I think, Momo, we can't delay this meeting. I think you and I should talk tonight. Tonight I'm out. I'll speak to you over the weekend. I'm going to meet in for 3 days, but I mean, I can, you know. Yeah. Over the weekend, let's talk about it. On Monday, I will do a slightly tinker the draft with the same issues, but the dates will change, and we will have to look at Thursday afternoons and Fridays where possible.
Okay. But Chair, just to add, look, I think, you know, we are constrained by time, but we're not that far back in the sense that if you take the rates bill, we've already done all the non-VAT bits. We've already had the response document. And the only thing now is the minister can go ahead and table the bill, because remember, these are all draft bills, and the MTBPS is not really a factor, except that there's definitely a plenary on that day, and therefore the minister...
Talk outside.
Yeah.
You already brought it all of this, right? I will come with a position, Otandi will on Tuesday, to say this is what we're going to do, based on the money bills acting. In other words, you know what we're talking about, please. We've always finished the bill before the MTBPS. And then all that happens is the minister gazettes it, right? And tables it, sorry.
Instead of formally table.
Yeah, table it. Then we don't do anything with the bill. We just adopt it, right? You know, that's the way we've done it. This is the way Parliament's operated all these years, right? But here, this time around, because of the contentious nature of the VAT, it may mean that the rates and monetary bill, you can't vote on it until, you know, you finalize the TLAB and TLAB bills. You see, what we can try to do is try to finish everything by September 17th. That's our target, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair, yeah, I mean, as I said, you know, the minister, the only constraint on the minister, aside from having the hearings completed, is that there is actually a plenary. We have a crisis sometimes that there's no plenary, and so he's got to wait for a plenary to table the bill. So certainly on the rates bill, on the non-VAT issues, he can do that. And we do have a choice. I know you don't like this choice, that whatever zero rating and so on can be done in any of these bills. It doesn't have to be only in the rates bill. It could be done in the TLAB. They're all changing the same acts. So, I mean, the rates bill could, in the current form, be passed. You know, the minister could table at the first plenary and it could be passed now, it could be out of the way. And then we could have these hearings and the schedule, because it's a schedule that will change, that could be done in one of these bills.
We've discussed this. You know the point here. You see, if you adopt the rates and monetary bill and then say to people, well, you know, yeah, we didn't. Nobody's going to. That's why I said to Momo repeatedly,
yeah.
He wanted me to adopt, well, not me, us. He wanted me to be convinced in the first instance, I can lobby you, that let's finish everything, right, even before August. And then we deal with that. And I said, no, we'll deal with all three, because the issue spills across. We should have a package and do with it.
No,
but if you talk outside this meeting,
okay.
I will brief Tandi over the weekend, she'll brief you guys on Tuesday.
So good. I think the bigger issue, and maybe just to answer one of the questions, is the question that Mr. Lee's pose, that whatever we do, you know, is it 4.8 billion if you took all of those as zero-rated items? And then what do we do to fill the gap? And as you know, mid-year we don't normally increase the tax. So it will create those kinds of problems that either we cut expenditure through the adjustments budget or we raise it through some tax mid-year, if there is a gap. I think the second issue and what the department's looking at is, though we've got the work of the panel, we are just doing our own estimates of, is it only 4.8? Is there not sort of upside risk of the amounts being more? That's something that is part of the process of going through it, including, I think, the question you asked about, I think many of us were surprised about the white bread. The Department of Health has said, for example, that white bread is fortified. And the reality, and here's the issue, that if many poor households are having white bread anyway, not going to shift to brown, you know, if you want to mitigate against poverty, that's why they've chosen white bread. But we also want to use this opportunity to have a more formal consultation both with the Department of Health on the white bread issue, and secondly, on, like, the recommendation, say, on school uniforms, requires, they're assuming that the Department of Basic Education is going to agree to a uniform, public uniforms, okay, or the same for all schools, okay. But like Fran said, he's got a white shirt on. How do you know whether the white shirt he buys is for school uniform or for his own non-school use? That's going to be, you know, or socks. I mean, and they make the point in their report that it's going to be very difficult to do that, okay? And how do you do it? So SARS definitely needs to come in on what's the scope of abuse for any of those proposals if they're taken as they are. So those are the things that we'd be looking at as well. So, but I think the big issue is if there is a revenue gap, how is that going to be dealt with? And that's why in this case the MTVPS will be important, because that's the only place that the minister could make some sort of announcements of this nature. So in that sense, I think this is linked. I think on the issue of annuitization, Chair, I mean, I agree with you. We're not that, you know, if there's no change, we've been to Labour. We're saying you have to do something. Otherwise, you're going to have a crisis, and it's going to be around in election time, and that would be very messy. So we've used that to try and get them to come up with an agreement. So even tomorrow we have a big meeting. So let's hope something comes out. But I don't think we will definitely have to amend something. So that will be coming. I should add that the carbon tax is ready to be approved if you don't have much to do, Chair. Remember that the whole issue of the jobs report is not, it's going in parallel, and it's going to be ongoing work to see what the impact is going to be over time. And I think that's an issue. So it's a plan for the future. And there are lots of job opportunities as well in this instance. Okay, that's that. I've dealt with the annuitization, the process issues. I think Mr. Lees asked the question just on what's the cost of the deduction. We can get some numbers for you. We don't have it on hand now. But remember, the one issue is what's the cost in terms of revenue foregone because people have used the deduction. The other side of your question, if people have then already cashed out, we can get that, but it's maybe a bit more difficult. Hey, what do you think? But we can try and get it from SARS. Do you want to answer all your hard questions on trucks? And
not at all. So to take the truck one first, since MoMA has raised it. I mean, we're a creature of statute, so we can only exercise the powers that are granted to us. So you're quite correct. As we sit here today, under the current Customs and Excise Act, the empty truck and the full truck both stop, report themselves, and are processed. The difficulty is in the new Customs Act, it refers specifically to a truck with cargo. So on a purely legal basis, a truck without cargo could say, well, we have no obligation to report. So it's a legal point. So we wouldn't have the legal power to stop the truck without the cargo because the law says you only have to report if you have cargo. So we're fixing that glitch in the system. The question of verifications, this is quite a difficult one. But at its essence, a verification is where we have a piece of information that contradicts what the taxpayer has said, or there seems to be an anomaly. So that's where, you know, on the VAT side, you've said your turnover is this much, but when you declare income tax, your turnover is something different. Well, that's something that should be easily reconciled, sometimes not so easily reconciled, but conceptually they should have been the same. So what was the difference? And that would be the same for some of the deductions and income that you see. So, I mean, banks send us details of the interest you earn. If what you're declaring as interest earned and what the banks have sent us don't tie up, well, could you please explain to us what the difference is? So that's the sort of verification aspect of it. An audit is when we're starting to look at your affairs in more depth. So we have a range of audit interventions we can have. They would start with what we would call a limited scope audit. So our risk engine has picked up that perhaps your ratios and your financial statements look out of kilter compared to what the rest of the industry is showing us. So there seems to be something in that particular area that needs to be dug into a little bit more depth. We go all the way through to comprehensive audits where we do multiple tax types and look at an audit, a taxpayer's affairs across tax types end to end. So it's once you cross that Rubicon into the audit space where we're going to have much more detailed engagements that we start with an engagement letter to lay the groundwork. It tells you, dear taxpayer, you have been identified for limited scope, whatever it is. And we'd like to see you in, and we have to make an appointment with you. That's what the Act requires of us. We would like to see you in 4 weeks' time at your premises, or could you provide us with this kind of information before we come see you for that more detailed engagement. And because it's a more detailed engagement, then there are more requirements for SARS to fulfill. So the new one that we're proposing is that we send you an audit engagement letter to let you know what you're in for. At least to start, because obviously once we're there and we might find other things that start tumbling out of the closet, and then obviously we'd extend. But if nothing does, well, it could be skeletons, could be other things. Might be interesting documents that fall out the cupboard. So, and that's also where, because audits can take a lot longer, we have that requirement that at regular intervals we need to report to the taxpayer this is the status of your audit, and then finally when the audit is closed we let you know it's closed, so that there's that process that goes through. To your question on set-off, the tax ombuds issue with us, if I remember correctly, was that we were withholding refunds for audits in respect of subsequent periods. Now, the way that Section 190 subsection 2 of the Tax Administration Act is written, is we can withhold the audit, withhold the refund if there's an audit for that refund. So that is ring-fenced. Okay. When it comes to set-off, that we can do across tax types. So we can take a VAT refund, offset it against your income tax liability, and then if there's still money left, go and use that to satisfy some of your customs and excise liability. And going the other way as well. So that is not limited, but that is within a particular taxpayer. So, if you had a group of companies, we couldn't take the refund due to the subsidiary and set it off against the holding companies. So branches we can, because it's a single legal entity. It's just one entity. It's purely for VAT purposes that they are considered separate, and I put this in inverted commas, taxpayers. But legally they're not. You would sue the same directors if there was something going on. And then there was one other point which I thought was relevant here, and that is returns outstanding in the VAT context. So if you do a refund for this period but you haven't given us your return for the subsequent period, then we can withhold the refund. That is permissible in terms of Section 44 sub 7 of the VAT Act. The reason for that is you may well have a huge VAT liability in that outstanding return. So please give it to us so that we can check, and then we can make the refund for the one that's... So that is permissible. But if you had an income tax return outstanding, for example, you would still get your VAT refund. It's purely in the VAT space, in the VAT Act.
All right. Thank you, Chair. On your two difficult questions, the CIS. Currently, the Income Tax Act Section 25BA makes provision that distribution by a collective investment scheme to unit holders, distributions that are not of a capital nature, are subject to tax. So that's where the play comes in. Because what happens is that we found that some CIS, they do the trading and then they distribute. And then they argue that those distributions are not of a capital nature. That's where the issue is. And the problem is that the word capital nature of that concept is not defined in the Act. You have to go to the case law. So it's on a case-by-case basis. So now what we are proposing is that if is the 1 year holding period rule to say that if you did not distribute within 12 months, then we'll deem that as of your capital. But if you distribute within 12 months, it will be regarded as revenue. That's what we are asking. Yeah. That's all. Like, it's like a 1 year period to say that. Okay.
Yes, there were. Mr. Chairman, no, this one I really need to apply my mind because I've already got people from the outside lobbying me on this one. So I don't want to say things that are nonsense because that's, for me, that's very easy. I very frequently don't know what I'm talking about. But. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm making light of your meeting, but it is true.
What he's saying is, it's fine, and it's a but I also know that you don't understand,
we've also had people, you know, on some of the, you know, even though there's a comment period, you can see sometimes people feel more strongly about some issues than others, right? And I think we say to them, look, we just remind them, look, the tax process, you know, we do something for some reason, we take comments, we're quite ready even to make significant changes. We don't ever go by what we have. And we understand with tax policy that maybe you're heavy-handed in some instances, maybe you're too light-handed in some. And that if they just focus on giving us their comments, we can then start engaging with them more directly. And often you'll find that different perspectives even within that industry. So it gets to, like last year we did the doubtful debts for the banks, right? You may get different perspectives, but you know, we already know which proposals are red hot and where we need to focus on the consultation.
Okay. The second one, doubtful debt. You ask, a doubtful debt is a debt that you are not sure you're going to collect. So a company will look at its book and say, we've got 100 debts in the end of the year of assessment that we think we're not going to be able to collect. So what you are saying is that you can only claim 25% of that doubtful debt. 25% of 100 means that you can only claim 25 rand as a deduction, like as an allowance. Previously, it was discretionary. So when the discretion of the commissioner was removed in 2015, we said you're going to set out a criteria, but that criteria was never set. Yes.
Let Chris come in a sec. So, Chair, if you remember when we introduced it, first was for 2 years only, and then we had to do a review. And bear in mind that you only get data, firstly, you've got to exhaust the full year, the full tax year, and after that you've got to wait at least 6 months before data comes out. So we did do an initial review. We pointed out the data was, we only had 1 year, effectively. Now, it's come up for the second renewal. We've got more data, which Chris can talk through to us, and that also comes in quite late. But part of it also is that the President, when he launched the YES initiative, a big part of that is the tax incentive, and if anything, the demands are to expand on it. So, we're doing the review because we're required to do so. That was the commitment and what Parliament required us to do. So we're going through that at NEDLAC. Hopefully it's a quicker process. But do you want to come in?
Thanks. I mean, no, just to say, so we're doing another, we've done one review which we then sent to you and then the ETI was extended. We've started doing another review now that we that NEDLAC will then pass on to you. I'm sure they will. And then this, I must check the first big main meeting was today, and there were some a lot of research has been done by researchers up to this point, and they're starting to now present. So I must check with the our officials who went in there like today. We can get back to you on that. Hopefully it will be soon. And then this in the law here is to say that they, we will do another one in 3 years' time. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Get well soon, eh? Tuesday you should be as fit as a fiddle. Fiddle.
It's the law now presenting
something which you don't know, but it's pretty much 5 years. No, look, I think if you go back into the tax legislation, we must check. So it is, when they approved it for appeal. And I think even in the law or in the ATC report, the report that they had,
yeah,
it required us to do a review.
Yeah, now talking about the extension for 5 years, was that something which President Ramaphosa announced,
yeah,
or did he just say we're going to extend it, are we going to extend it?